Good afternoon, counsel. Welcome to Division 2 of the Court of Appeals. We have one case remaining on the 230 docket. That's Cooper versus Simmons Heppner. Counsel present and ready, it appears?
Yes.
All right. Simply to give you some guidance for those of you who have not argued here before, this case is set for 15 minutes per side. You'll be guided by a lighting system which works as follows. When the time commences, the red light, or the green light on the podium, rather, comes on. When 10 minutes have expired, the amber light will come on, and when your full 15 minutes have expired, the red light will come on. Appellant may reserve whatever part of the 15 minutes you wish for rebuttal. And you'll be guided by the timer on the podium because it counts backwards, so it tells you how much time you have left. We've read the briefs in your case. We're familiar with the facts as you've set them forth, so to the extent you want to proceed directly to your legal argument, that's fine with us, but the case is yours to argue as you wish. If you have a cell phone or a pager, please ensure it's turned off. Please stay close to the podium because we're recording your arguments. We may find it helpful to go back and listen to them again if we need clarification. And if you stray from the podium, your voice will not be picked up well. Feel free to adjust the podium upwards or downwards with the use of the toggle switch. We're ready for argument. Go ahead, counsel.
May it please the court, Matthew Barringer on behalf of Ms. Heppner, registration number 35429. Just so the court is aware, I'm not going to have a very lengthy argument. There's simply one thing that I do want to point out to this honorable court, and that is this. It appears, and obviously I can't speak for the appellee, but I'm going by what is in the briefs and also with the trial court, it appears that the three of us are all in agreement on one thing, and that is Ms. Heppner is a tortfeasor. And that these payments were not made by a collateral source. Perfect example is in the court's order on page 4. See, because defendant's payments were not a collateral source, this court is not required to reduce the jury's award. In pleadings filed by opposing counsel, the defendant is a tortfeasor. So by that virtue alone, I think, and I'm saying that as well for the appellee, or appellant rather, that she is a tortfeasor. As such, the collateral source rule does not apply. It appears in this, as it stands now, is that the appellee is able to have its cake and eat it too, in that it's not collateral source payments, so we can't reduce the verdict, which I've never, as counsel, never asked for, because I don't think this is a collateral source issue. I think it's payments made by Ms. Heppner, the tortfeasor. Now, in the original minute order precluding and the order that was made on the record, if memory serves, it says that our Exhibit L was precluded from being presented to the jury and any testimony associated with that because of either pursuant to the statute that I've referenced in the pleadings and or the motion for or the order for summary judgment. The order for summary judgment had nothing to do with the Exhibit L that I wanted to tender. It was more to the collateral source rule. Because of those reasons, I think that it was reversible error because the jury was to be held to believe that Ms. Heppner did not pay for any of the bills associated with this alleged attack. Well, I'm not even say alleged, it was an attack. Really what this case came down to was a damages hearing. Now, we did have a counterclaim for outrageous conduct. Quite frankly, I was surprised that we even got past summary judgment. In my view, it was really what it boiled down to was, what's the damage and what is it worth? And not being able to show the jury, hey, Ms. Heppner has made payments to the defendant, now, understandably, through victim's compensation, and she was ordered, as the court well knows, but those payments were made. And as such, the inferences could be made, and if memory serves correctly, opposing counsel on direct examination asked the victim, did you have any of these bills paid for, or did you have any insurance, rather, as I think was the question was, and she said no. So the jury is to think, A, this woman, you know, violently beat her, and B, made no attempts to make her whole in any which way by paying for bills or the like, because they never got to hear that. And for those reasons, I believe that was reversible error. I would ask the court vacate the order of the trial court and set it for, and make, so I can set it for a new trial.
Counsel, go ahead.
Go, please.
Let me just ask you a couple of questions.
Absolutely.
So it's undisputed that your client paid $3,340.90 to the victim compensation fund.
That's correct.
And it's also undisputed that Ms. Cooper received that amount from the victim compensation.
That is correct.
Is that right?
That is my understanding, yes, Your Honor.
So assuming that we agree with you that $3,340.90 should not have been included among the damages that were awarded by the jury in the civil case, wouldn't it be a sufficient remedy for your purposes if we merely remanded with instructions to the court to reduce the judgment by that amount?
Well, and I'm sure opposing counsel is going to argue this, is that at this point I never made any record as to with regard to having that reduced. So I don't know if the appellate court is in the position where they can, because I may have objected because I didn't believe that the rule applied. I think the proper remedy is for her to be able to be reheard on this matter, because, and something that I forgot to mention was that I also was unable to cross-examine her with regard to how the bills were paid for. She was on the stand and said, I incurred $13,000 in medical bills, which were never given to victims' comp. For what reason, I don't know. And I was never able to inquire to that, because none of those any other evidence with regard to whether or not bills have been paid at all, I couldn't even go there with that. So I would submit that the proper remedy in this matter would be to have it reset for another one-day trial to jury.
Well, I didn't understand that that was the subject of appeal, that anything other than the $3,300 was the subject of appeal.
Well, and something, quite frankly, and I don't mean to ambush or anything, it was just something as I was making my final arrangements for today, I kind of realized, oh, that's another issue that ought to be raised.
Okay, but you didn't raise it.
No, I did not.
Well, let me also ask you, is there any dispute whether the expenses that are covered by the restitution award are the same expenses that were the subject of the civil verdict?
I apologize, I don't quite follow, I apologize.
Well, there are certain items, the expenses that are being compensated for through restitution are itemized. Is there any dispute that there's any difference between those and the expenses that were at trial?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
Is the claim, see if I can understand this, is the claim being made, that you're making the claim now, that the failure to get this exhibit in was erroneous?
Yes.
Is that the only claim?
That's the only claim. And for whatever reason, I don't know if it's something that's not translating in my mind or I'm not conveying it properly or the like, my sole argument was never, and not once in any of my briefs, to say this needs to be reduced. I've not raised that argument once. What I've said is that by virtue of us not being able to try to get Exhibit L in, and any testimony with regard to that as well, I think even more importantly, for her to say, yeah, this happened, and we had some things going on back and forth, I had to make payments, I made those payments, and as far as I know, I paid for all of her medical bills. That's the argument that we are asserting to this court.
So you're asserting that your prejudice is that the jury believed your client didn't make any payment?
Exactly, Your Honor.
And they may have punished her for that?
I think that they certainly should have known about it. Now, I can't speak to whether they punished her or not.
Well, they awarded punitive damage.
Exactly. And the thing was is that they never knew. They were not able to take that into consideration when they were doing, okay, you know, she said she incurred these bills, we have these hard bills in front of us. And as far as they knew, they were still outstanding. So they were led to believe not only this person is a bad person, assaulted this poor woman, and on top of it, she didn't even make any way of making it good. And I think that would prejudice her, absolutely.
Well, were you precluded from introducing evidence through your client about these payments?
So I understood I could not bring up, I apologize, but my recollection was absolutely, and I remember having a colloquy with the court to say, so what you're saying, Judge, is I can't say anything about these payments, anything. And he said, because it was at that time, it was his decision, as memory serves, that it was through the collateral source rule that we would not be able to bring up any of those bills to be paid, that were paid.
If you had examined your client on that, wouldn't the cross-examination have brought out the fact that this was as a result of a criminal conviction.
That was already stipulated to you.
And that your client did not pay it until she was faced with revocation and probation.
Yeah, that would have come up, and the jury could have weighed that, but that never happened. And the jury was well aware by virtue of a, I can't remember what it was captioned, but essentially, it was, I believe it was race judicata, that it was litigated, one, in the criminal case. As such, it's binding in the civil matter. There wasn't much I could do to fight that. They were well aware.
That was the summary judgment, though, on liability, wasn't it?
The summary judgment was as to the outrageous conduct, our counterclaim for outrageous conduct, and I can't remember, maybe opposing counsel can give you more flavor, what the other portion of that was. We prevailed as to the outrageous conduct claim, which I said, as I said before, I was surprised that we got over that hurdle. The other one, I think we conceded by virtue of that they were right. They had the case law, and that was it. So, if memory serves right. Anything further?
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Jim Rouse, number 10675, representing LaSonya Cooper this afternoon. One of the frustrating things about this appeal has been trying to figure out what the appeal was about. Now, first it was collateral source rule that, they should have allowed it to come in. Now it's not the collateral source rule, it's simply a payment. But it's not really a payment, it's part of a criminal sentence. Ms. Heppner contends, at least in her briefs, that she herself, as one of the terms of her criminal sentence, made this payment, and she's therefore entitled to the benefit of CRS 1321111.6 that requires a reduction. All that was kept out was Exhibit L. My understanding of it was that they could have put on whatever case they wanted to put on, and they just didn't do it. Ms. Heppner treats the Crime Victim Compensation Fund as a mere conduit for her own involuntary payment. This was not a voluntary payment. How the defendant can then argue that she would somehow have been portrayed in a better light by making a payment she was forced to make upon penalty of having her probation revoked is just doesn't make any sense to me at all. I don't think that...
I take it there's no dispute, though, that the defendant did pay the $3,300 into the victim's compensation fund?
Your Honor, my client has no firsthand knowledge of that. There was no evidence of that in the court. All that was introduced was Exhibit L, which looks like a docket sheet showing what happened. It appears that somebody made a payment into the victim's compensation fund on her behalf. Whether it was her or someone else on her behalf, we don't know.
But let me ask you this. Is there any dispute that your client did receive the $3,300?
My client did receive $3,300 from the victim's compensation fund. And that paid, and reimbursed her for a portion of the bills that she had incurred.
Are you familiar with CRS 18-1.36036?
I can't say that I am, Your Honor.
It provides that any amount paid to a victim under an order of restitution shall be set off against any amount later recovered as compensatory damages by such victim in any federal or state civil proceeding. Are you aware of that statute?
I am not, Your Honor. It was never raised in the trial court. And,
but under that statute, isn't the only possible remedy, is the only reasonable remedy to send this case back to the trial court to have that amount subtracted from the judgment?
Well, that would be raising a new issue on appeal, Your Honor, which my understanding isn't supposed to happen. The reduction in amount for whatever theory was never raised with the trial court. At the conclusion of the trial, the judge asked everybody, is there anything else that we need to address? And both sides said no. And so they waived their right to have any reduction because they didn't raise it in the trial court under any theory.
Well, they offered the one exhibit, though, that in essence was his way of saying, we want to show that she paid this? Isn't that sufficient to preserve the issue? I mean,
I don't think so. Once he's given another chance to raise the issue as to any reduction after he sees what has happened, all that was the exclusion of an exhibit. I don't think that there was an exclusion of testimony. I mean, if she thought that she had reimbursed my client in some fashion, I think that could have been brought out at trial. I mean, he didn't try to bring it up at all.
Well, your opponent just said, one, he offered the exhibit, and two, he's telling us as an officer of the court, I wish there were a transcript of this, but he's saying the court said, I don't want to hear this evidence.
I don't recall that being the case. You know, we got the trial exhibits, and voila, here's this exhibit L in here. I made a motion in limine to exclude it.
What was the basis for your motion?
You know, I don't recall right offhand. I believe it was that it would be prejudicial to my client. It would be like an insurance payment or something like that, you know, that she is supposed to, the damages stand on their own, and then there's whatever subrogation or collateral source rule reductions or whatever later. And I did argue that it was not a collateral source at that time. On the motion for a new trial, the issue of reduction was not raised under any theory. All she wanted, all they argued was excessive damages, and therefore were entitled to a new trial. The court found that the damages were not excessive. The issue of excessive damages is not on appeal, it's reduction all of a sudden, and that just plain was not raised at the opportunities to raise it. It's been waived. But I would agree that the most they can get out of this appeal is a reduction in the amount of the $3,300, but that would have to entail a finding that they did not waive their rights to it. And, you know, frankly, this issue that, you know, she made a payment to compensate my client was not phrased that way at all until this afternoon. Always before, it's been she paid the victim's compensation fund, and therefore, you know, it's a collateral source. I mean,
well,
I think
counsel, there is a document that was filed, at least in connection with the motion for the new trial, which reflects the restitution payment and what the payments are for.
In the motion for new trial?
Yes.
Yeah, but he doesn't ask for a reduction. He simply asks for a new trial. Now, I think if you want the remedy of reduction, which is what he's asking for, apparently, you have to raise that. I mean, you don't get a new trial just because you didn't raise an issue in the trial court.
I see your point, but also the statute that my colleague read is in the nature of a directive to the trial court, and it's not something that really comes up during the trial, as I read it. I admit you're under a disability not having that. Maybe Judge Casebolt would give you time to respond, a few days to respond on that one statute. So you could look at it yourself, but it does seem to me, I didn't know about that statute either, by the way, I've just never seen it come up, but it seems like it would be self-executing. The court shall reduce the judgment. It wouldn't seem to go to the jury.
Well, I think that it has to be brought to the court's attention, and it was not brought to the court's attention. I mean, this is the first I've heard of it, the statute. I apologize for my ignorance of it, but I mean, if you look at the opening brief filed by the defendant, it's a statement of issues presented for approval for review. Does the collateral source rule pursuant to section 1321.111.6 CRS apply to payments made by the collateral victims compensation fund? That's the issue that's before the court, and there's been no argument on it, and the payment by the collateral victims compensation fund, and that being a collateral source payment, was never raised in the trial court. It was the payment by the tortfeasor, which is not subject to 1321.111.6, and I don't think at oral argument they can change the rules of the game or what we're supposed to be arguing about. Is simply not before this court. I don't know what else to say about it. Unless there's any more questions, I don't have anything more.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before you make your final statement, Mr. Berenger, because we have cited to the parties a statute that neither one of you have cited in your briefs, you'll have an opportunity to respond to it. If you would simply address a letter directed to all three of the panel members. Don't route it to the clerk. Simply direct it to all three panel members separately, and make it no more than three pages, double-spaced. Tell us what your position is on the statute. Sure. Judge Miller, do you have that?
Yes, sir. It's 18-1.3-603, paren 6, close paren.
And again, just limit your arguments to that statute only, if you would. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Derringer, you can, you have some time left if you wish to use it.
Excuse me, Your Honor, how much time do we have to submit that letter?
If you do so within 3 days, we'd appreciate it.
3 days, all right, thank you.
Yes, well, today's Wednesday. How about next Monday?
Monday.
That gives you over the weekend if you need it.
May it please the court, just a couple of things, just a couple of things to clarify. When my office filed the motion for a new trial, it wasn't simply just for excessive damages. It was also whether or not Section 1321-111.6 CRS, whether it applied. And this isn't a situation where the undersigned is trying to switch the game, change the game, and the like. It's always been my position, and I apologize for any sort of confusion. When I laid out the statute was to show, you know, kind of give, the court's well aware, but obviously I've got to give the court a little flavor of where I'm going, what the statute is, what's its purpose, its function, all of those things. What I was trying to convey, and obviously I did not do a good job for opposing counsel, was that the seminal issue is, does that statute apply? Because that is what the trial court hung its hat on when it said you cannot bring in Exhibit L. And if, and I could be wrong, and if I am, but as I recall from his the colloquy I had with the court, is that he said you cannot mention anything on direct cross, yesterday, tomorrow, nothing on this particular exhibit or any testimony that flows from it. And so my contention throughout the request for a new trial, for purposes of today, my opening and any reply brief, was that that it's my position that that statute does not apply, and as such it was error for the judge, for the trial court rather, to preclude it from any testimony and any other evidence with regard to that to be presented to the jury. That is the issue that, as I see it, that is before the court. I understand this new statute, and obviously I'm going to look at that and file something with the court in a timely fashion, but it would be my request to have the order of the trial court to be vacated, remanded with orders to have it set for a new trial. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
All right, thank you, counsel. I appreciate your arguments today. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. That concludes the docket for the day. We'll be in recess. The bailiff may so announce.